I'd like to present today the certain work that we did for the last about 4 years with my students. This was my first student working in this field, Adrian Dragulescu, who already graduated, get his PhD, and now work as a risk analyst in an energy company. And that's my second student who continues this work. And so I will show you a lot of data plots in this talk. So all these plots were produced by the students, so they were very essential for this work. And this work was published in some journals, and there is I have a web page, so if you are interested in references and everything, all materials are available on this page. So what this talk is about? Well, I call it Statistical Mechanics of Money, Income, and Wealth. So let me then start with reminding you very briefly the basics of statistical physics, which of course I'm sure you all know. So the fundamental law of statistical physics is the Boltzmann-Gibbs probability distribution of energy. That's where every textbook on statistical physics starts. So usually it appears in one of the first chapters in the book, and then all the other chapters in the book, the rest 500 pages of the book, is consequences of that. And derivation of this Boltzmann-Gibbs law, which is basically Boltzmann-Gibbs law, says that probability to find energy epsilon is exponential function of energy epsilon, okay? And derivation of this fundamental law is usually very simple, very short. It takes at most one page in any book. Well, there are different derivations, you know, in different books, or you can find different derivations in the same book, but they all basically about the same thing. So I just briefly show one of the simplest derivations, which gets the main idea, okay, what is behind this law. Let's consider a collision between atoms. And by the way, I should have said that the subject of my talk is, you know, I'm for exotic programs, so what could be exotic then applying this to economics? And it's not relevant not only for exotic program, but also for quantum gases, because we consider collision between atoms, right? So let's consider collision between atoms, okay? So two atoms, one atom has energy epsilon 1, another atom epsilon 2, they collide, so some energy delta epsilon is transferred from one atom to another, so they fly away. Notice that, of course, energy is conserved in collision. That means the sum of the initial energies is equal to the sum of final energies, okay? And then if you have statistical equilibrium, okay, in statistical equilibrium, we would have detailed balance. In other words, direct and reverse processes, the transition rates due to direct and reverse processes must balance each other, so the probability distribution function doesn't change anymore. The probability of direct process is proportional to occupation number of initial states. That would be probability to have energy epsilon 1, probability to have energy epsilon 2. Now, the transition rate of reverse process would be proportional to occupation numbers of final states. Okay? And so in equilibrium, these two products must be equal. Okay? And then the only function that satisfies both of these equations simultaneously. In other words, we'll see that energy is additive and probability is multiplicative. And the only function that satisfies both equations is exponential function. That is it. End of the proof. Okay? So we conclude that in statistical equilibrium, the distribution of energy is given by exponential function. Now, energy of energy. Energy, of course, has dimension. So we must divide by some coefficient of dimensionality of energy. And this coefficient is called temperature, as you all know. The physical mean of temperature is actually nothing but average energy. So for this distribution, the average energy for this distribution is basically equal to temperature. So temperature is average energy per atom, say. Okay, and of course, we know that this distribution maximizes entropy. Okay, distribution of energy is characterized by entropy, and entropy is maximal when distribution has exponential form, provided under constraint that total energy is conserved. So this can be derived by just a maximization of entropy, for example. Okay, so these are very simple and very general principles, okay? And as you see, there are very, very few assumptions that go into these derivations, basically conservation of energy and statistical equilibrium. And so, generally speaking, they should be applicable to much broader class of systems, not necessarily physical systems, to broader class of statistical systems. So let's consider a completely unphysical system, which is economy, okay? Now let's make this analogy. Let's consider some economic transaction between two agents. So agents have some money, M1 and M2. So they make some transaction, well, buy and sell something. So some amount of money is transferred from one agent to another agent, right? But the sum of initial and final money is conserved in this local transaction. So money is locally conserved, okay? Point is that we cannot manufacture money. You cannot sit and print dollar bills. We can only get them. Well, some people do. But normally, you know, we get them from somebody and give them to somebody. We only get them, give them, and that's it. So it's only transfer, process of transfer, okay? So then in that simple idealized situation, we have conservation of money. And the question is, what is the probability distribution of money in statistical equilibrium? Okay? Well, by the same logic, we should apply detailed balance and get exponential distribution of money. So the conjecture is that probability in the statistical equilibrium in a closed system, okay, and there's idealized, usual idealized physical reservations, probability distribution of money should be exponential function of money. Well, because money has some dimensionality, say dollars, it should be divided by a coefficient of same dimensionality, which we call money temperature, and it is nothing but average amount of money per agent.
Victor, I'm yes. Sure you tell us, because I'm sure I asked you this before. Government prints money.
Yes.
That leads to inflation and all these other
yes.
things.
Yes.
Is that, and I'm sure you have a clever answer, is that incorporated somehow later on, or yes. it's something I'm going to ignore? We are in an ideal society, but there is so much money, or there is no government.
Okay, yes to everything. Okay, so point is that it's like external flux. So in physics, we start with the idealization of closed system, but of course then we can go to external flux. For example, we receive energy from sun. That's, you know, we can incorporate this. It doesn't violate any, you know, fundamental principles. So the same story here. Government would print money, that will be external flux, which will drive, for example, you will see actually temperature, money temperature increases in time. It doubled for the last 20 years. But that's like a slow influx, you know. It's not hyperinflation.
So that's the non-equilibrium version of this.
Yes, exactly, exactly. So if rate of influx is not very high, it would be close to equilibrium. Yeah. No, because it conserves stationary distribution. So you say in stationary situation. So I say, what is stationary distribution? Okay.
Steady state.
Yes, exactly, exactly. I'm looking for steady state. Okay. Yes, but again, I will start with the idealization of closed system. Let's forget about this external influxes of money. Let's say we have closed system, no external flux. Just a bunch of closed agents, okay? And they do their economic activity, okay? And that's what is the state.
Closed system which is not an equilibrium, you need not a way to get that.
Yes, yes, yes. This is yes, yes, yes. This Chris's remark is much better remark, indeed. I skipped this, I mean, I flipped under the rug. That this equation implies time reversal symmetry. Because in physics, in fact, transition rate is equal to transition probability times occupation numbers, okay? And in physics, we have fundamental symmetry, right? Time reversal symmetry, such that transition probability of direct and reverse process, which should be here, should be written here, are actually equal, and so you can cancel them out, and that's why we get exponential distribution. So in other words, in physics, the important ingredient here is also time reversal symmetry, okay? Which is not always clearly stated in physics textbook. For example, in Landau-Lipschitz course, that formula was derived in volume 5, statistical physics, but the time reversal symmetry was not mentioned until volume 10, which is physical kinetics. Okay, but it's absolutely right. And now, and the point is, in economics, generally speaking, there is no fundamental requirement that there must be time reversal symmetry. Okay, in fact, many things flow in one direction. For example, get money from an employer and give them, you know, spend them in a grocery store. No, not the other way around. Okay, however, so in other words, this is, I would say, Gibbs distribution is kind of semi-universal. It's universal if model has the right symmetry, time reversal symmetry. Then distribution is universal and does not depend on details of the model. On the other hand, if time reversal is broken, then you might have something else that's possible. Okay, so in economy, there's no reason why, fundamental reason to expect time reversal symmetry, but there's no fundamental reason not to have it, okay? So in other words, it's a practical question. It might actually be the case, or might be approximately the case. And that's what we're going to explore in the following. So in other words, consider this as some sort of motivation for the following day. I will show two theoretical slides, this one and next one. And the rest of the talk will be data. What actual data tell us about real situation, okay? So other questions? Yes?
So the definition of money is like the economic definition of money, assets, and bonds, everything lumped together, right?
Okay, let's go into definitions. Okay, so full disclosure. It's important to distinguish between money and wealth. Okay, so by money, I mean something like cash. I mean cash or equivalent of cash, okay? As opposed to, say, property, which I call material wealth, okay? This part is not concerned, because what is material wealth? It's like, say, like goods, like, for example, we have a house, okay? House has a price, okay? This one is not concerned, because for one thing, goods are not concerned. You can build a house, you can burn a house, right? So you can manufacture things or consume things. So goods are not concerned, and their price is not concerned. Price may go up and down. So dollar expression of the value of your house may go up and down. So this part is not concerned. But this is cash. You see, cash you only get and give, right? So it's like liquid that flows in, you know, in this between the wheels of economy.
Is cash or equity? What are you talking about? There are different things in economics: cash and equity. Equity is the whole thing, which is what is being asked.
Yeah,
you know?
I guess what you say, what you mean, equity is equivalent to what they call wealth. I think wealth is everything.
Equity should be bonds, stock.
Yes. For example, let's take stock. For example, let's take stock. Stocks. Okay. Stocks have a price. You know, you have number of stocks. If you want to translate into dollars, you have to multiply the price. So that part is not conserved. Okay. So I'm looking only for this part, okay? And in fact, most of the talk I actually look at discuss income, which is actually time derivative of money, which is even different.
Real money can be converted into stock.
Huh?
Money that is conserved can be converted into stocks that isn't.
Yes, exactly. But the point is this: if you want to sell your stock, somebody for cash, okay? Somebody have to give you that cash. Somebody has to have that cash and be willing actually to give it to you, right? So in other words, you'll get cash from somebody. Yeah, you can try to convert it, right? But how much money you get depends not only on you, you know, but also on somebody else who is willing to give you that cash and who actually have it. Okay, so I mean, it's these are interrelated things, of course. Yes.
Just one more thing to bug you with, but that's it. Cash is not conserved in banks.
Okay. Yes.
Money.
Yes. Right. Right. So yes. So this is about debt. So this is about debt. In fact, in every an economic textbook, there is a chapter called "How Banks Create Money," and the way they create by debt. So debt is negative money. It's like particle anti-particle creation, right? If somebody exactly when you go to bank and take a loan, right, you get the cash, but you also get obligation, you get liability. Okay. If you take the sum of this, sum is still zero. But the economy textbooks somehow count only positive part of cash. They say, oh, you got cash, great. So cash is not conserved. But the fact that you get obligation, somehow they don't count it into this equation. And so for them, it's not conserved. Okay? But I count both, so for me, it's not conserved. I mean, sorry, it is conserved because you have positive and negative parts. Okay? So algebraic sum. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's move on. Fine, so let's see. And so to convince ourselves that, you know, what I told you about exponential distribution is kind of reasonable, we did some simple computer simulation just to maybe be a little bit more comfortable with this. So as it is actually popular in these days in economics, we considered what's called agent-based modeling, although it was very primitive. We took like 500 agents, gave them same amount of money, let's say $1,000. Okay, so initial probability distribution of money is essentially delta function. So all agents have the same amount, $1,000. And then they start to transfer this money somehow randomly. So the assumption is that there is some economic activities behind these transactions, but we don't care what is exactly economic activity. We just keep track of transfer of money. And as it starts to transfer, this delta function naturally broadens because they don't have the equal amount anymore. It broadens pretty much in Gaussian manner, the usual diffusion, and broadens. But then what happens is this, that you see this money axis, it has a boundary zero. So in this modeling, we permit only positive money. In other words, we do not allow debt. Again, in this idealized situation, we do not allow debt, which is negative money. So there's a boundary condition, okay? So money can go to zero, I mean, money balance of an agent can go to zero, but not below zero, okay? And in physics, that corresponds to vacuum. You must have a vacuum, a state with lowest possible energy. Otherwise, you cannot define Gibbs distribution, okay? And so there is impenetrable boundary on this side, but there is no boundary on the upper side, can go anywhere. Okay, so that kind of Gaussian is spreading of this delta function, okay, and starts to accumulate on that side because probability cannot penetrate through this boundary, so it starts to accumulate here. And distribution becomes asymmetric and eventually stabilizes the exponential shape, okay, and then it doesn't change anymore. So we arrive to stationary distribution. So then agents continue to transfer money, but probability, the histogram doesn't change, probability distribution doesn't change, and of course it is exponential, as it is illustrated by log linear plot. Make log of probability function of money, you get straight line, okay? So that's, you know, pretty trivial simulation. That's what we expect from physics, okay? Now, so, but the real question is the following. Does it correspond to any reality, I mean, economic reality? Okay, so we started looking, being physicists, as opposed to mathematicians, we started to look for the data to compare with experimental data, okay? And what we found is that, well, what we didn't find is any data on distribution of money as such. By this I mean money balances, but we found lots of data on distribution of income, okay? Because people pay taxes and so income is reported. And so we said, okay, even though this theory is not quite developed for income, let's look at income anyway. Hopefully they're somehow related and, you know, let's look at the data anyway, it's interesting. So the rest of the plot will be shown the data, okay? Fine, So, and there are several different sources for this data. I mean, all of the data I'll be showing you, all of the data was downloaded from the web, from public websites on the web, because these are public agencies. Okay, so one source of data is actually U.S. Bureau of Census, okay? And the good thing about this site is that from that site, we can download actually raw data, actual records, and make their own statistical histogram. So what we did, we downloaded data and plotted probability density as function of annual income in thousands of dollars. So this is income of $100,000 per year, individual. So we divide this axis in some sort of bins, okay? And calculated how many people belong to each bin, so we produce this histogram. So histogram is produced on the basis of this data. And the solid line is a fit to exponential function. And you see the fit is pretty good. Well, there is some small deviation at very, very low incomes, less than $5,000, which of course you would not expect very good data at very, very low incomes anyway. But if you plot in log linear scale, this is log of probability and income, okay, you see it's a pretty good straight line, and that deviation actually doesn't look so bad in logarithmic scale, because that's the appropriate scale. So it is...
Are you sure it's income, not salary? Because that tail doesn't look right. I mean, it's basically way below 1% for 120K annual salary.
I think Shankar says the following, points out the following, that if you ask, wait a second. No, let's be careful here. This line is probability density. Now, normalization of probability density is a bit strange.
Okay.
You see, it ends at 10%. So this, for example, is 0.1%, but doesn't mean anything. Because probability density is a little bit strange thing. Okay? Much better thing is cumulative probability. Okay? And most of the plots I will show you afterwards will be cumulative probability. And yes. So normalization is strange here, actually. Doesn't mean much. But for this curve, there's a second curve here, which is actually from... So I said conclusion is the distribution is exponential. And the second data set of points B, this is from university studies. It's pretty standard reference for economic studies done at the University of Michigan. And so this is this line. And this is cumulative. So this is actually normalized to 100%. And so, well, we'll discuss this in a moment. Percentages we'll discuss in a moment. Okay, anyway, so these are some sorts of data. And of course, the major source of data is Internal Revenue Service, the American tax agency, which receives something like 100 million tax returns per year. And they, in fact, have even a research division called Statistics of Income Division that makes publications and writes papers and makes the data available. Disadvantage is that they give already pre-aggregated points. In other words, they essentially report percentage of population at certain income levels. Okay, so we don't have freedom of selecting data points, but we have data points themselves. So what I show here is what's called cumulative probability. Cumulative density is integral. It's essentially number of percentage of people with income above certain income, okay? And as Shankar said, for example, for 100K, if you ask what is percentage of people with income above 100K, well, in this case, it's about 5%. So 95% of population have income below 100K. That, of course, was for the year 97, okay? And so again, this pretty good exponential fit, so log linear scale straight line, and this is data for another year. Okay, so what we see is the distribution of income is indeed exponential, at least for the great majority of population, at least for 95% of population, okay? But you might ask, what happens above this 100K? So I stop this plot here. What happens above, okay? To show that, I have to switch to log-log scale, because otherwise I run out of space on the figure. And that's another data we found from IRS in a different publication. This is on this log-log scale, and this is up to $1 million per year. Okay, and as you see, somewhere above 100K, the law actually changes. See, below 100K, in other words, the law changes. So we have two distinct classes here, lower class and upper class. So basically what we see is the evidence of two-class society. Well, as a physicist, you see, look at this curve, and you see very clearly see the two different regimes, right? Okay, so let's call them classes, right? Why not? So there is lower class, okay? So lower class is here. And for the lower class, probability distribution of income is very well described by exponential Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution. So this is the fit in log-log scale. If you replot the same data below 100K, straight line in log-linear scale, so it's exponential. And there is upper class, where distribution actually fits by straight line in log-log scale, which means distribution is power law. So that's so-called Pareto power law. Pareto was actually an Italian physicist who became economist. I would say he was one of the first econophysicists. He lived at the end of 19th century. And he analyzed distribution of income and wealth at that time, at the beginning of 20th century, the end of 19th century. And he found power law, okay? And that power law is, he became a famous economist, and this Pareto power law is very well known in economics, okay? However, what is not known to economists is that, it really applies only to the upper tail of distribution. And what they don't know is that the bottom part, the great majority of population, is described by a different law, which is Boltzmann-Gibbs law, okay? Pareto law is equivalent of power law, okay? Pareto exponent, well, is exponent of that power law, okay? So there is exponent, I will show you exponent later. Yeah, power law has an exponent, of course, and I will show you exponent. Mm-hmm. Okay, and in fact, this kind of distributions are actually not unknown in physics, as I learned, in fact, at the faculty meeting in our department. It's like this kind of distributions are actually observed, for example, in space physics, like cosmic rays, or solar particles, or electrons in plasma, etc. They have this kind of two-part distribution. The lower part is called thermal, and the upper part is called superthermal, okay? Because they're highly energetic particles, and this is actually not uncommon in physics. So it's natural to call these two classes, societies thermal and thermal bulk and superthermal tail. And let's discuss a little bit parameters of that. First of all, you'll probably be interested where exactly the boundary is, at what exactly income the boundary is. So we can draw the vertical line, and let's call this income. Oh, by the way, I use letter R for revenue. Revenue would be for income, okay? So R is income, okay? So the boundary in this case, let's call it R star, the boundary. And for this year, the value was about 120K. So 120K was a boundary between upper and lower class in 1997. And I'll show you data for the later years. And you may ask, what is percentage of people in these two classes? So let's look for the upper tail. If you draw this line, this corresponds to 1, 2, 3%. So this, so the upper tail consists of 3% of population, okay? And the remaining, the great majority of population, 97% of population, belong to the lower class. And by the way, there is no signature of middle class, because the line is completely smooth, completely straight, all the way from 120K to zero, okay? So operationally, I cannot define middle class, but I can define upper and lower class.
I thought that if you look at your division and lower income, you would think that the one really satisfying your load is the middle class, whereas the one division at low income is the lower class.
You mean here?
Yeah.
But you see, points are pretty dense here. You see, below 20K, points are pretty dense.
But at the previous plot, you showed
Yes. But you know, remember that the drop in the previous plot happened on the level of 5K. I don't show you temperature. I'll show you temperature. Temperature in this case is of the order of at least it's about 30K, 35K. Okay, so that's the average income. Okay, and that drop of the data was in the level of below 5K. So it's a very, very low income. Okay, and you know, I wouldn't expect reliable data in this range. So even if there is missing space, I can still say that extrapolation law looks pretty well. You know, even if some weight is missing there, but extrapolation still works pretty well. So it's pretty good approximation anyway. Okay, so I wouldn't worry too much about this very missing weight at the very, very low end. Okay.
This two-class distinction that you found, how universal is it? Is it for all countries?
Okay. Now, and the next question I want to address in this audience is time and space dependence of that. Okay? So let me start with time dependence, and later I'll address space dependence. Okay? So question, so this for one particular year. How about other years? Okay, and that is recent work we did with a second student. So what we did, we analyzed data, IRS data for 20 years, from 83 to 2001. Okay? And this is the data. What is shown here is a bit busy plot. Let me try to explain. First, we look at the lower class, lower part of distribution, where we expect it to be exponential. And we make those plots in log linear scale, okay? And for each year, the line is a straight line, okay? The slope of that curve line is temperature, right? Because temperature coefficient. So for each year, we determine temperature, that is average income in that year. And it changes in time. So it was something like 19K in 83 and something like 40K in 2001. So this is a list of temperature for each particular year. And then what we do, we rescale. We plot here income divided by the temperature of that particular year. So we rescale horizontal axis. And in this coordinates, all those points for different years collapse on a single line. Okay, all the straight lines become one line. And just for clarity, we show separately a line for 90s and line for 80s, just displaced vertically. Okay, and these are cumulative distributions, and these are probability densities for the same years. And yes, you may see some jobs here. I mean, you see some turned down at very, very low incomes, okay? But, you know, it doesn't change the fact that overall exponential fit is, you know, pretty good, you know, at least in the first approximation fit. So basically what conclusion we make here is that that is observed very robust exponential law for the great majority of population. So it doesn't really change in time, except for change of temperature. Yes?
The numbers that you wrote for the income temperature,
yes?
Are those adjusted for inflation?
Okay. These are not adjusted for inflation. This is nominal income. It's just in nominal dollars. It's not adjusted for inflation, and I will show inflation a little bit later. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, so this is the lower part, the lower exponential part. Now, how about the tail? Okay, and here I plot the same data in wider, broader scale up to, this is income relative to temperature. So this is 110, this is 100, this is actually 300 times income, which is 300 times higher than average income, than the temperature. That's broad scale. And then you see the lower part again, all points collapse on single line. So this is exponential part. And these are Pareto tails, these are power law tails. So at the high incomes, we indeed see those power law tails. But you may notice that these tails do not scale, meaning they do not collapse on a single line for different years. That means the parameters of the tail do significantly change from year to year, as opposed to lower part where only temperature changes and that's it. Okay? So let's look how the parameters of the tail change in time. Okay? What happened for the last 20 years. So these are the plots. It's again busy plot. Let me go of course one by one. Let me start with the top curve. So on the horizontal axis, we show time. So this is 83, and this is 2001. By the way, 2001 is the latest data available, IRS data available now, because it appears with some delay. Okay, so the upper curve shows Pareto exponent. So this question, so Pareto power law means that cumulative distribution function goes like power law with some power, with some index here. And so what is plotted, the value of that index? And you see it is not constant, it changes. And it changes from 1.7 in 83 to 1.3 in 2000. So there is no true universality. It's not like phase transitions when there is fundamental value of. It changes from year to year, from country to country. For example, for England, I will show you, like, it will be like 2.1. Okay, but it's not. But it doesn't. But it's confined to a not so broad range between 1.5 and 2 approximately. Okay, so it does change. Now, what more interesting is the following. The fraction of income in the tail. Let me explain this concept. You see. Pareto tail decays more slowly than exponential, right? So that means there is extra weight in the tail as compared to what you would expect for exponential, okay? And so the question is, so we may ask, what is extra income contained in the tail compared with exponential, right? In other words, excessive income in the tail on top of exponential. And take this as a fraction of total income of the system, okay? And this percentage changed in time. So, for example, in early 80s, in 83, this percentage was about 4%. And since that time, it was growing, non-monotonously, and reached peak at year 2000. So at peak, the fraction of income in the tail was about 20%. So it essentially changed by 5 times, from 4% to 20%. But after year 2000, started to go down. Okay, and what happened in year 2000? Stock market crashed. Okay, so on the bottom line, we show stock market divided by inflation. This S&P 500 divided by inflation. And you see very similar patterns. Stock market goes up, income in the tail goes up. Stock market goes down, income in the tail goes down. Okay, and other things go, you know, similar ways. And even increase of stock market by inflation was about 5 times, you know, similar to this one. Population in the tail also changes. It changed from 1% in early 80s to about 3% in, you know, late 90s, but then started to decrease again. So what we may conclude is that the tail is really strongly correlated. Is first of all, changes non-monotonously in time, goes up and down, parameters change, and this correlated with stock market. Okay, and how about the bottom? How about the exponential part of the distribution? Well, let's discuss average income temperature. So again, there are many curves. Let me go one by one. So the red curve here is the temperature. How temperature was changing for the last 20 years? It's again nominal temperature, nominal dollars. As I said, it essentially doubled from 20K to about 40K. Remember, the tail increased 5 times. Temperature increased only a factor of 2. But most of this increase is inflation, because the blue curve is inflation, the consumer price index, and CPI increased by factor 1.7. So out of this factor two salary increase, it was 1.7 was actually inflation. So most, if not all, of nominal increase of average income was actually inflation. Okay, and gross domestic product per capita also goes along the same line. So what you may notice is that all these lines go pretty smoothly, pretty steadily, you know, pretty much linearly with time. Nothing like what we have seen for the stock market, no ups and downs. There are some effects. For example, salary was increasing fast and then it slowed down after the collapse of stock market. But overall, you see, this structure is much, much weaker than for that upper tail. So I would say this is like a big thermal bath, okay, which is enormously stable. And this jumps, you know, of stock market just make like a relatively small perturbation for the big thermal bath, okay? Another question you might ask, what is shown here is income separating exponential power loss. Remember that boundary, okay? And latest year, 2001, that boundary jumped up to 140K. So if you want to check in to which class you belong, you should look at 140, but although this was for 2001, and I don't have the very current data, okay? And the ratio of the boundary to the temperature was actually declining from about 5 to about 3, and then started increasing again. So you need to have salary from 3 to 5 times higher than average salary to be qualified for the upper class. Okay, fine. Okay. Now, so this was just the data. Okay, now I want to show a little bit of theory again. So how we can rationalize coexistence of exponential and power law tail. And one simple way of doing this is on the basis of diffusion model. So let's consider income kinetics. In other words, let's consider now, that's what we consider kind of static equilibrium distribution. But it can be obtained in principle from dynamic equation, how probabilities change in time, evolve in time. And the simple start, you know, reasonable starting point would be diffusion model. We say, let's suppose income changes by some amount delta R of some delta, time delta T. Let's say income changes from year to year. Some people get promoted, some people get demoted, some get fired, some get hired, and so on. So the salaries change in time. And let's say this income changes are relatively small. Then probability distribution, the time evolution of probability distribution, would be described by Fokker-Planck, standard Fokker-Planck equation, which has this form. Where A and B are coefficients. The A is first moment of this income changes, and B is second moment of the income changes. So this is a standard equation from physics. Right? And if you want to consider stationary distribution, we set the time derivative to zero. That means this part must be equal to zero. So this is equation that determines stationary distribution. Okay, now, for the lower class, okay, it's reasonable to assume that the income changes are independent on income itself. So in other words, we have additive diffusion. So income may change by increase by 5K or decrease by 3K and so on. So in this case, the coefficients A and B are constants. Okay, they don't depend on R. And if A and B are constants, then of course you can immediately solve this equation and find the solution's exponential function with temperature, which is a ratio of these two coefficients. Okay? But for the upper class, it is more reasonable to assume that the income changes are proportional to income itself. In other words, income change by percentages. And that's maybe called multiplicative diffusion. So in this case, the coefficients A and B, A will be proportional to R, and B will be proportional to R squared. So if you take these coefficients, plug them in here, you will see some sort of conformal structure. And the solution of this equation would be power law, okay, with exponent, which would be ratio of these two coefficients. And so I would make a conjecture that the income evolution for the lower class is additive diffusion and upper is multiplicative. And I don't have, you know, hard, okay. For this was actually studied quantitatively for the upper class by the Japanese researchers who analyzed tax data for Japan for the upper class. Reason is, in Japan, actually tax agency publishes the list of people, I mean, publishes the list of names and incomes of the upper class people. 80,000 people, they publish list of names and incomes. Okay, so you can trace income of each person in Japan. So you can trace evolution. And then you can do all this quantitative. You can see income changes from year to year of these 80,000 top people.
And what would they define their upper class, not by your definition?
Okay. 80,000 people, by any means, a small fraction. It's a small fraction. Top income. It's always top. I mean, what is published is always top income. So the Japanese agent publishes top income people. And so only that they publish. And they trace them. And what they found is that there is a certain probability distribution of percentage income change, okay, which does not depend on income itself. You know, as long as you belong to the upper class, the probability to change, the, say, by 5% is the same, no matter what is your income. They check it quantitatively. So this is actually a very good piece of work. And by the way, Aoyama, I mean, this actually, some of them are actually high-energy theorists. Aoyama was actually a postdoc of John Schwartz and Kalchek. So, and some of you may actually, and he's professor of physics in Kyoto University now. So some of you may know him. And Fujiwara, I think, was also in high-energy theory. So they did really excellent piece of work for Japan. Now, unfortunately for US, this list is not published, so we cannot do this. And for lower class, it's essentially not available. So what is exact truth for diffusion for lower class, I don't know exactly. I can only give anecdotal evidence. This year, I actually served on the salary committee of my department. So this theory was kind of very useful. And what happened is this year, our chairman told us that we should consider salary change increases in absolute dollars, not as percentages, but absolute dollars. Okay, so in other words, additive. Because otherwise, you know, few people with very high salaries, we do it by percentages. Few people with very high salaries would exhaust all the fund. So he said it makes more sense to do it in absolute dollars. And in fact, that's how other departments do it. Okay, so.
But you violated your theory. A few people who are in that upper class,
yes,
did not give them percentage raises.
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Right. Right. Well, they may not get annual percentage raises, but when they get their raises, well, it is kind of proportional, because if somebody has an income, you know, above 200K or something, you know, giving 5K doesn't mean anything, right? So if income is big, to make substantial difference, it has to be commensurate, right? Whereas for lower class, it's just absolute dollars that matter. Yeah. Okay. Well, now, another question that I want to discuss now is income inequality. Because, of course, you have distribution, right? So you have poor people and, you know, so on. So, yes?
Is there a difference
between
the salary
assigned
here, or is it more that upper class
is
mostly their income coming from investment?
Yes, absolutely right. Very good point. Absolutely right. The sources of income is different. Because for the lower class, income is wages and salaries. So this is decided on the basis of budget, you know, budget is limited, so in. But for the upper class people, these are investments, capital gains, and those investments or capital gains happen in percentages. If price of stock changes, well, the dollar value gets multiplied, okay? So the sources of income are different. That's, I think that is the major reason. The source of income is different, okay? Fine, so let's discuss income inequality, which is, of course, is an important question. So there are some standard ways of describing income inequality in economics, so let me introduce them. So one is called Lorentz curve. This is, of course, different Lorentz. This is economics Lorentz. Lorentz curve is constructed in the following way. The advantage of this curve, with this curve, we can see the data all the way from zero to infinity, whereas in the previous plot, I had to truncate it somewhere, even in log-log scale. The way Lorentz curve is constructed is the following. It has two coordinates, x and y, horizontal and vertical. And the curve is defined parametrically as function of some parameter r. So R is the upper, so we pick some income R. So X is fraction of people with income below R, okay? And the vertical coordinate Y, we do take this integral with income itself. So this is income, total income of all those people with income below R as a fraction of average income. Okay, so and then we sweep R from zero to infinity, the upper limit. And in this way, we get a curve that goes from 0, 0 to 100%, 100%, okay? And so the data points here are shown. These are data points are from IRS for two different years, 83 and 2000. And solid lines are theoretical fits, which I'll describe in a moment. Well, in fact, let me describe them right now. So if probability distribution is exponential, then I can simply plug exponential, take the integral, and explicitly calculate the curve. And the curve, Lorentz curve, turns out to be completely universal, no fitting parameters. It turned out to be y equal to x, 1 minus x, log 1 minus x, this factor. So we get some universal curve without fitting parameters. And that's what we did first. We plotted that curve, which is not shown here. And it fitted the data pretty well, but there was also visible deviation. And then we later realized what is the source of this deviation. The source is the existence of the tail. Okay, this distribution is not exponential for the whole range of income. There is also upper tail. And then we realized that, in fact, fit can be improved if you take into account this tail. And it can be improved in the following way. In fact, what we need to do is adjust the scale of vertical coordinate. You see, here we divide by the total income of the system, but if you divide by the total income in the exponential part, the curve should do, you know, perfect fit of the points until you reach the end. And so that means that produces this formula, where this function x, y minus x, etc., is multiplied by some reduced weight. F is a fraction, so this reduced weight, and the rest of the weights goes into delta function at x equal to 1. So it corresponds to the following. As we start from low income and go up, we follow that curve, that curve, which is x minus x, etc., this universal curve. And then, when we almost reach 100% of people, there is a vertical jump. Vertical jump is why? Because the tail contains very small fraction of population, like 1 or 3%. So it's essentially zero on this scale. But their fraction of income is finite, is significant. And so this jump is a fraction of income contained in the tail that I was showing you before. And that fraction was 19% in year 2000. But it was much smaller in the year 1983. It was only 4%, and maybe it's maybe difficult to see it. So the fraction, if anything happened for these 20 years, the fraction of the tail grew significantly, and it pushed down that curve. Okay, but once we take into account for that weight redistribution, then this formula fits. You see, the solid lines fit the experimental data pretty well. And the Lorentz curves are very well known to economists. I mean, they are published by Rest, etc. But they have no idea that they can be fitted by that simple formula. Okay, so that's what physics can contribute here. Now, another important thing is something called Gini coefficient. So Gini coefficient is a certain measure of inequality, one number which measures inequality. Well, you may realize that the distance between the actual curve and the diagonal curve can be taken as some measure of inequality. Because suppose everybody had the same income. Then the line would be just diagonal, because fraction of income would be proportional to fraction of population. Of course, the real curve is not diagonal. And you can take the area between these two curves as a measure of inequality. Well, let's normalize it to the area of this triangle. Then we get this Gini coefficient G that changes between 0 and 1. So 0 would be no inequality, 1 is complete inequality. Now again, for exponential distribution, we know the function, so we can calculate that area, and we find the Gini coefficient for purely exponential distribution is just 1/2. 1/2, which is between 0 and 1, right? And between 0 and 1. And so this is theoretical value. And the data, the blue points, are Gini coefficient as calculated by IRS. And you see, for the last 20 years, it was increasing. So that means inequality was increasing for the last 20 years, which I told you already before. But nevertheless, deviation of this data from the theoretical value 1/2 is still not very far from theoretical 1/2. It was below 1/2, then it became above 1/2. And moreover, after the crash of stock market in 2000, started to decrease. Okay, so when I showed this plot to economists, I said, oh, it looks like system has self-correction. It's self-correcting itself. When it deviates too much from equilibrium, well, it starts to relax back. And that was this, and that what that crash was about. Relaxing back to normal, because that was a speculative bubble. Okay, now things are getting back to normal, to something that Boltzmann-Gibbs predicts. Okay, and we can fit this. And as I said, the value is 1/2, but that is for purely exponential distribution. If you take into account the existence of the tail, then Gini coefficient becomes 1 plus f, where f is fraction of the tail. And that's shown by red circles, and you see they fit the data pretty well. So we can quantitatively fit it. It doesn't fit it here, because in the late 80s, inequality was actually less than 1/2, because you see points actually go above the curve. So there was somewhat reduced inequality in the early 80s. Anyway, okay, so thus far I consider distribution of individual income. But related question is distribution of family income. Because what we learned is that very often data is quoted income per household or per family, because economists consider this as a better measure of whatever, distribution in society. Now, then we can do a very simple exercise. Let's consider a two-earner family where there are two spouses and each spouse has some income. Okay, and the question is, what is the probability distribution of the family income, the sum of two incomes? That, of course, is a simple exercise. All we have to do is to take convolution of distributions of individual incomes. If distribution is exponential, then, of course, we multiply exponential, we get exponential again. But we also get a prefactor, because integral goes from 0 to r. This is like phase space, because you see, if this is one income, this is another income, they're both positive. The sum is constant along this line. And the length of this line is proportional to total income itself. So what we get is a function which is linear times exponential. And this function is plotted here. And the histogram is obtained on the, is plotted on the basis of data from Bureau of Census. Again, from Bureau of Census, we downloaded family income data. And this is the data for families with at least two adults. Okay? And you see the fit, the agreement is pretty good. Notice, by the way, the difference in shape of individual distribution and family distribution. For individual income, distribution was pure exponential, right? Pure exponential. It has maximum at zero, which means that the most probable individual income is zero. Okay, as opposed to average income, which is temperature. But that's not true for the families. For families, the most probable income is temperature, whereas average income is twice the temperature, because there are two members. Okay, and when I was giving this talk, people often ask me, oh, how come you make, when you multiply probabilities, you assume that incomes of spouses are uncorrelated? That cannot be true, because people marry similar people, etc., they must be correlated. Okay, so we check this. So this is scatter plot. So this is income of one spouse, and this income of another spouse. And the plot is symmetrized with respect to diagonal. Okay, so well, we don't see any significant correlation here. Maybe there is some residual correlation, but certainly there is no strong correlation. The points are distributed pretty uniformly in this direction. Density, of course, decays this way when total income increases. But the relative income, they distribute pretty uniformly. And that gives a kind of important message that when systems are very complex, very complicated, like, you know, people, economy, sociology, psychology, or whatever. You know, you might think they're very, very complicated, but they become very, very complicated. At the same time, they become very simple. So the very simple statistical assumptions, which you know, in this talk you have seen already very simple statistical assumptions, they actually capture behavior actually pretty well, at least in the first approximation. So when systems are very complex, they may become very simple from statistical points of view. And basically this shows that system fills all available phase space. So these families fill all space. So you can find examples of all kinds of families with all kinds of relative distribution of income. Now, how about inequality for family income? Well, we can construct this Lorentz curve now for families, for family distribution. And this is again a universal curve. It is different, has different shape from individual income. And you may notice that it's kind of closer to the diagonal. There is less inequality for family income because distribution is more compact. Okay? And so this is a theoretical curve, no fitting parameters. And the points here are data from Bureau for the last 50 years, from 45 to 95. And these points move up and down, up and down. There's no systematic trend here. But they're pretty close because the agreement is really pretty good. There is some deviation at the upper end because, of course, there is a tail, which is not taken into account here. But overall, this agreement is pretty good. And let's look at the Gini coefficient. Again, because we know the average analytically, we can calculate this area and calculate Gini, take your integrals. It turns out to be 3/8, fraction 3/8, which is 37.5%. So this theoretical number. And the points are historical data on Gini coefficient as posted on the website of Bureau of Census. And the agreement is amazing because, you see, value 1/2, we could guess. Well, 1/2 is between 0 and 1. But 3/8, I don't see any way to guess it. It has to come from calculation. And it does agree with the data. And as you see, for the last 20 years, from 80s, whatever, Gini coefficient going up, as I told you, inequality was increasing. But for the previous years, it was decreasing, increasing, going up and down. So it's going all kind of ways, but not going anywhere far from that equilibrium value. It just fluctuates around this equilibrium value. And that basically brings to some kind of philosophical conclusion, which is kind of important message here. Well, we see no significant changes in Gini Lorentz for the last 50 years. That means exponential thermal distribution is very stable. And why it is so stable? Because it maximizes entropy. Because this distribution corresponds to maximum entropy. So if you try to deviate, if system tries to deviate from the distribution to either way, either less inequality or more inequality, that decreases energy, decreases entropy. And that is again the second law of thermodynamics. And so second law of thermodynamics would restore it back to the maximum entropy. So we basically arrive to the concept of equilibrium inequality. Okay, which is just based on the maximum of entropy, and which is 1/2, Gini 1/2 for individuals and Gini 3/8 for families. So this was data for the United States. And how about other countries? What happens for other countries? We don't have very systematic data, but we have some data. So this is data from the World Bank. World distribution of Gini coefficients averaged by regions of the world. So what we've shown here is Gini coefficient for different regions for two different years, 88 and 93. So let's look at the first columns. Western Europe, North America, developed capitalist countries. So this is the Gini. And the horizontal line is that magic number that we calculated, 37.5%. And you see the numbers, the values are pretty close. So what it tells us, first, inequality doesn't change significantly. And second, it is very close to the equilibrium value in developed capitalist countries. Now, other regions, Asia, South America, Africa, everywhere inequality is higher than equilibrium value. And it is very well known that inequality in developing countries is higher than inequality in developed countries. Okay? Perhaps they are out of equilibrium or whatever, not well formalized, perhaps. And special case is Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union. Maybe I should show this. Okay, so Western Europe, I told you, other regions are higher. And what about Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union? Well, before the collapse of communism in 1988, inequality was substantially lower at the level of 20-something, 24% or so. As you would expect in a socialist society, inequality would be less. Okay, but once those rules, those restrictions were removed, and it jumped way above the equilibrium value. So in other words, it is possible to enforce externally, artificially, lower inequality, but it's not stable by itself. Once you remove those restrictions, it goes out of that. And why it is high, this was 93, why it is high here? Because I think system, at least 93, is still out of equilibrium, it still has not thermalized, it still hasn't relapsed. And basically what happened to this country, especially the Soviet Union, the wealth was very very concentrated, was very highly concentrated, was all state property. And so it was easy for few people to grab it under privatization. And so a few people grabbed all that wealth and became extremely rich, and other people didn't get anything. So the point is, this wealth was not mixed into the population. Okay, and so that's why inequality became very high. But the fundamental reason is because system is out of equilibrium. It's still not well mixed. But hopefully with the time it will get mixed and it will relax to equilibrium value, maybe. But maybe, this is data 10 years old actually, so I don't know the current data. Okay, so that was, So I guess it's time to wrap up the talk. Yes, I'll be wrapping it up, okay. Now, so that was variation of income, etc., in time. Now, what about variation in space? Well, this is already variation in space. I started this topic. How about variation of temperature in space? Well, I was often asked about different countries. Well, different countries are somewhat difficult to do because you have to know language and everything, so it's difficult. But somebody suggested, why don't you take a look at states of United States? So that's much easier. So we looked at this data from IRS for income for different states. And this small inset is basically a log linear plot of income distributions for different states. There are basically 50 points here, which are not distinguishable. But the point is this, as income increases, this 50 distributions kind of spread. And as you might imagine, the number of millionaires in Connecticut is 10 times higher than in West Virginia. So different states are different. Okay. However, you can make some sense out of it. If you look at the lower part, you might see kind of that these lines are basically linear. That means distribution is exponential in the lower part. And for each state from the exponential slope, we can determine temperature of that state. And then we can rescale. We can plot here income for each state divided, normalized to the temperature of that state. And then you see all points collapse pretty much on a single curve. So the shape of, which is basically exponential, see log linear scale, it's a straight line. So the lower part is exponential, and the upper part is power law tail. And the shape is pretty much the same for all states, but there are variations in temperature between different states. By the way, the circles are average for the whole United States. And so we can make a table of variation of temperature within the United States. So these are deviations of temperature in percentage from the average temperature. So the highest temperature state are Connecticut and New Jersey. Well, so that's, I guess, where New York stockbrokers live. They live in places like Princeton and something like that. So that the temperature is 25% higher than average temperature. And at the lower end, the lowest end, West Virginia, Mississippi, Dakotas, and so. So the temperature varies by plus minus 25% roughly within the country. Okay. Well, whether this variation is big or small, I'm not quite sure. I think it's not so big, actually. Yeah. But what about other countries? The only country we can really study properly was England. Well, no language barrier, and the data was available. And so what we found is that income distribution in England qualitatively is pretty much the same. It's pretty much the same shape. The lower part is exponential, log linear scale. The upper tail is power law. So Pareto, by the Pareto index, Pareto exponent is 2.1. So again, it's somewhat different from the United States. But interesting question, what is, and this actually, these are sets of points, 5 points, for 5 different years. So again, there is time evolution. Income increases in time. So it is rescaled here. But what is the British temperature? Okay, so the temperature, the slope in the year 98 was 12,000 pounds. And if you use the exchange rate of that year, that was $20,000. How that compares with American temperature? American temperature in IHS was $36,000. So the ratio is roughly factor 1.8. 8. So, roughly speaking, American temperature was 2 times higher than British temperature in the first approximation. Okay? So it is possible to have significant variation of temperature between different countries. And if you compare, say, United States with countries like China, India, Russia, surely the difference of temperature will be much, much greater. I don't have specific data, but it's pretty obvious. So one has a situation where different countries have very different temperatures. And if you have different temperatures in physics, what are you going to do? Thermal machine. Okay? So if there is a difference of temperature, you can make a thermal engine. So, and I think that thermal engine basically works in the world. That's how world economy works. So let me explain how the thermal engine works. So suppose we have these two kinds of countries, say high temperature countries, say developed countries, and low temperature countries, say okay, developing countries. Okay, then first observation, and remember, temperature is the scale of income. So the scale of income is very different. However, we assume that distribution of income is equilibrium, pretty much exponential in both cases. You've seen, for England, it's still, distribution has the same shape, but a different scale. So each one, it may be in local equilibrium, but their relative temperatures are different. Okay, second observation is that prices of goods within each country must be commensurate with the scale of temperature. In other words, the scale of prices must be commensurate with the scale of average income. Otherwise, people cannot buy anything. Okay, so that means in low temperature country, prices are low. In a high temperature country, prices are high. So what one then can do is the following. Then products can be manufactured at low country, at low price, okay, and then sold to high temperature country at high price. And the difference of prices would be the profit of whoever does this business, does this intermediary who does this business. So what happens in this case is that goods, products flow from low temperature country to high temperature country, and that's what we observe. If you go to supermarket, well, everything is made in China or something like that. All products are manufactured elsewhere. At the same time, money flow from high temperature to low temperature. Okay, and this is, in this language, this is nothing but second law of thermodynamics. Energy, as you know, energy, according to second law, energy always flows from high temperature to low temperature because that increases entropy. So because of difference of temperature, money would systematically flow from high temperature to low temperature. In economics, it's called trade deficit. So trade deficit, which we heard about, money flow out of United States. And from physics point of view, it's nothing but second law of thermodynamics. However, well, if we had full equilibrium, if all temperature would be equal, well, then one could not make profit because temperatures would be equal. So that would be something like thermal death of economy. Nobody could make any profit if everything is complete equilibrium. That's like thermal death of universe, which was discussed in the 19th century. So in other words, it is this non-equilibrium, this global non-equilibrium, which drives world economy for now. But what will happen in long time perspective, I don't know, whether temperatures will equilibrate eventually or not. But I think there is a certain tendency for temperatures to equilibrate, but we'll see. Okay, so that's pretty much concludes my talk. So these are conclusions. Let me just briefly summarize and repeat them. By analogy with between energy distribution and physics, we conjecture that money should be distributed, should have exponential thermal Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution. This one for, well, money and income for individuals and for families modified exponential. And what we observe is two class structure in American society. The great majority forms exponential thermal tail, thermal bulk, and there is small super thermal Pareto tail, which changes in time a lot with stock market. The exponential tail part is very stable, save for small increase, save steady increase of temperature. Pareto tail is not universal and changes up and down. Well, right now, it was increasing for the last 20 years, but right now it seems that it's relaxing back to equilibrium. It's shrinking and relaxing back to equilibrium right now, after the crash. There is equilibrium inequality in society, which is based on maximum of entropy. And these are the numbers, 1/2 and 3/8 for the Gini coefficient, which is numerical value for the income inequality, and this data agree pretty well with the capitalist countries. So thank you for your attention. Yes.
Your reports were in several developing countries.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Is that because they have not times which is reasonable, because they are not equilibrating?
It's hard to say. There are many questions. There are many questions about this plot. One thing one should be cautious about, that when they did this plot, they lumped together countries in the region. For example, if you look at Asia, Asia has very different countries. It has Japan, it has China, it has India, it's all Asia. So for one thing, they lumped together very different countries. And so it's not obvious whether it actually makes sense even to discuss average Gini for the whole region. It would be much better if they did it for individual countries. But for one thing, I couldn't find that plot. And second is, I want to show some compactified data. So it depends on the countries a lot. Okay, and a general kind of perception, I mean, I don't have hard data, basically speculation, is that for some of the developing countries, some of them, you know, don't have well-developed market economy. So they have like sort of, some of them have sort of somewhat of medieval kind of structure, when there is kind of rigid hierarchy, when few people control everything, okay, and the rest of the population is very poor. So it's not well developed market. Everything controlled by the top class, something like that. So that would produce that would be one reason for inequality.
So your initial model, when you write that slide, would be
nothing in
place. Yes, again. Your initial model wouldn't be active.
Yeah, exactly. My model would not apply. Yeah, exactly. So in other words, the model seems to be applicable and works well for Western Europe and North America, where things are really well mixed. There is lots of competition, market is very well developed. It's really competition that, economic freedom, etc., that allows it. These other regions may not have it, but it depends on each country specifically. Yeah.
So I gather that some of these regularities were not known to professional economists.
Yes.
And the question is, how do they respond when you inform them?
Yes, yes. Well, that's a very interesting question. It's not easy to talk to them. It's not easy. Interaction is normally not easy. I would say it's a question of diffusion of knowledge, I would say. It's really a question of diffusion of knowledge. We have different fields. There is a boundary. And to diffuse across the boundary, it's a very, very difficult, very complicated. Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely. A lot of them are very mathematical. But the problem is they're mathematical in different sense. Their mathematics is very different. So essentially, majority of them, at least mathematical establishment, okay, it is trained in mathematics which I would call Newtonian mechanics. They know ordinary differential equations. They know trajectories. They know game theory, they know mechanical equilibrium, like, for example, prices, demand equal to supply, forces on that side equal to forces on that side. So this kind of concept they're very good with. But most of them, many of them are not really, well, I'd say most of them are not really familiar with the concept of statistical equilibrium. They know mechanical equilibrium, but not statistical equilibrium. So, for example, they have a concept called representative agent, which means we have many people. Let's look for an average person, and let's follow the trajectory of that average person. It will give us some idea. That completely throws away the whole concept of statistical physics. And that's what they do, many of them, or most of them. Or game theory. Game theory is always, for most of it, typically it's not statistical. We have few players, and find optimal strategies. So it's few players. It's not statistical physics. So this statistical physics concepts are usually missing for most of them. Yes. Now about black holes. As I learned, as I was doing this, what I learned is there are actually at least two very different communities. There is, for example, in my university, there is Department of Economics and Department of Finance. Okay, and this is a very different world. They even belong to different colleges. Department of Economics belongs to College of Social whatever Sciences. And social behavioral, whatever, some sciences. And the Department of Finance belongs to business school. And it's a very different kind of people. People at the Department of Finance, they are much better trained. They know probabilities, they know stochastic differential equations, Black-Scholes, etc. And in fact, their faculty, they're mostly mathematicians. In fact, they come from their degrees in mathematics. So they are much more sophisticated. Huh? Yes, all physicists, exactly. So what I'm saying, those faculty come either from mathematics or physics, right? But you see, but the issues, but they are mostly in the stock market. They're interested how stock market fluctuates, how to gain money. So in other words, they're speculators, roughly speaking, okay? And by the way, we also do this stock market analysis, price fluctuations, which I didn't show here. Yeah? It's a different subject we work on. So they're much, much better educated, okay? But they're interested in different things. They're essentially interested in the upper tail. They're interested playing on stock market. I don't care about what happens to the majority population. Okay, and economists, independent economists, who are supposed to care about majority population, don't care because all they care about proving theorems, you know, game theory or something like that. So it's really quite difficult to find perceptive economists. Okay, so sometimes I find them some places, you know, but they are kind of minority in the academic discipline. Yeah. But this minority may eventually become majority at some point. Yes.
I have one other question, which was you started with a conservation of money.
Yes.
And a microscopic model where some economic thing happened, but money was conserved.
Yes. Yes.
I'll talk. About
yes.
Anyone on the income?
Yes.
Income isn't conserved.
Yeah.
And I don't see the microscopic process either.
Uh huh.
So you know, given that you've applied this to income and not money,
mm-hmm.
have you followed the microscopic sort of income distribution
that
leads to this?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. I mean, it's certainly true that there is a certain disconnect between the first part and the second part. Okay. So first part about money, it was nice theoretical model, but we don't have data for that. And the second part is lots of data, but we don't have a nice, elegant model for this. Well, I tried to say something about this diffusion model, so income diffusion, kinetics, how people change their income.
But income isn't conserved.
Yes. Now, this is a good question. So is income conserved or not? That's a very good question. There is no fundamental reason for income to be conserved, but there may be kind of practical reason. Let me show you number 10. Because you see, let's see, as a director of the institute, okay, you have certain budget, right? So, you know, you might want to increase somebody's salary, but you have fixed budget. So, or considering bigger scale. So, in a way, if total budget is somehow fixed, then to increase salary to somebody, you have to decrease to somebody else. Or, what actually happens, more realistically, is there is inflation. And for some people, at least that happens in our department, for some people, salary get increased faster than inflation. So effectively, their salary increased relative to temperature. And for some people, salary is increased less than inflation, or not even increased at all. And that people eventually drift behind the average temperature. So in other words, but playing this politics of increasing salaries and decreasing salaries, you know, that produces broadening. But the thing is that with a fixed budget, one might argue that that the sum of salaries is conserved. To increase somebody, you have to decrease somebody else. And of course, this should be enforced on kind of global scale, not necessarily on the level of a given company, but in a bigger scale. So, in other words, it may approximately be conserved. And one reason for this is gross domestic product. Because, in fact, I think one of the definitions is, in a way, you can argue that the sum of all salaries paid in the country is gross domestic product. And you see, it doesn't change much. It changes, it drifts, you know, steadily. But from year to year, it doesn't change much. That means the sum of all salaries paid in the country is approximately constant. So this is approximate conservation law, which you observe here. And in fact, the good part, and in a way, this Boltzmann philosophy may be even better for income, because income certainly positive, at least wage income, is certainly positive. We don't have problems with debt. With money, we could go into debt, negative money, all kind of complications. But with income, it's positive by definition. So in other words, these ideas may have broader applicability than one might naively, that I first presented. Okay, so I guess in the back.
Yes, I would like to address the value of the presentation. I'd like to suggest that physicists have something other to contribute than their mathematical abilities, which of course are excellent. I very much appreciate your data analysis. But nothing to contribute that physicists have is fair-mindedness. For example, in the time of the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
there was a regular dialogue between scientists and Soviet Union and America.
Yes.
To give a second example, I was in a collaboration in CERN in the mid-90s where there were Croatians and Serbs working together while their fellows were killing each other.
Yes.
So those are extreme examples, but I want to point out that a lot of what the language that you use would easily justify a lot of economic policies that would be somewhat damaging. For example, that the inequality between developing countries and developed countries,
uh-huh.
or the statement about what's going on in Europe. So,
yes.
For example, your measure of equality.
Yes.
I don't know what that has to do with the lower classes being able, as you put it, being able to eat or not being able to eat. So why use the word equality? Can you evaluate the measure of equality in a more physical sense? I don't even know what that means in terms of mathematics. Your measure of equality, you showed this trapezoid and you showed this ratio, and I thought maybe you could use other measures. Another thing is the data. On the lower end, I know you said that you didn't have such great data for below 5K, but that's
uh-huh.
actually the area where people, you know, might not be able to eat.
Yes.
So perhaps, I don't know, perhaps I draw the audience away with these comments, but I add that because I think it's something that physicists really do have to add, which is fair-mindedness, you know.
Uh-huh.
I want to ask you about that area.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I just want a very brief answer. That fair-mindedness. Well, you know, I haven't seen that term in physics textbook. Okay. So as a physicist, you know, as opposed to humanitarian, I don't exactly know what it means. Okay. So I stick to physics. I stick to terms which belong to textbook of physics. Okay. And fair-mindedness and that kind of things, fair, unfair, I leave it to humanitarians, okay, economists, philosophers, and that kind of people. Okay, so I stick to physics. Okay, that's my personal kind of attitude. Okay, but it, of course, a fair question in society. Right? But anyway, other question.
Well, I think we better
wrap it up. Okay.
Better do the rest in private. Thanks.
Uh-huh.